Welcome to Leader Insider Secrets, where we get to the source of success. Hear from leaders who bear all and share their insider secrets, along with my episodes aimed at optimizing your performance, productivity, success, and well-being. Hi, my name's Estelle Reed at B.Company, and I'm an executive coach, trainer, and author of Inner Brilliance, Outer Shine, which explores 10 antidotes to imposter syndrome, workaholism, and stress. Okay, let's begin.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I have with me Debs Jenkins, founder of The Asset Path. Did you like that voice?
I did. That's my favourite voice.
We did a little practice before we went live. Now, Debs, she loves showing smart consultants. I did say to her, does that include me? And she said no. And experts how to turn their clever thoughts into valuable things. And she is a writer, an author. I'm holding up, for those of you that are not watching this, you're just tuning in. This is how I came across Debs. She wrote The Gorillas Want Bananas, and she helped me to write my own book, Inner Brilliance, Outer Shine. I've had to look at the title then. That's terrible, isn't it?
No, it's normal.
10 antidotes to imposter syndrome, workaholism, and stress, which is the topic of this series of the podcast. But in addition to being a writer and author, and her latest project is Better Than Great, we'll dig into that in a bit because I'd like to know more about that. She's also a writing and creation coach, and that's how Debs and I know each other, because she was my amazing book coach and stopped me from procrastinating for 10 years. And without her, I don't think I would have got it past the finishing line. So she's an absolutely amazing woman. Not only, in fact, I was talking about you this morning to a fellow coach. I said, not only is she a brilliant coach, she's also one of the best businesswomen that I know.
That's so cool. And that you've got
a brilliant business brain on you. And whenever you and I catch up, I always learn something new. So you are a complete inspiration. But when I got Debs to fill this in online, so they have to fill in a questionnaire, and I said, what do you want for your biog? She said, short ass with a big gob. So you can see, we're going to be in for some fun, folks, I think, today.
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking, well, we've already been chatting, and the thing that I've already taught you today, which obviously you never knew before, and now everybody has to know, is that the pee sticks for finding out if you're in the menopause or not. And I think that's really, really important, because there comes a time in a woman's life where she needs to pee on a stick and find out what the hell is going wrong with her crazy brain. So anyway, now you know. Guys, I don't know what guys should do. Maybe they can pee on a stick. It's up to them, really.
Yeah, I don't know. It's whether there is a male menopause. There's been some debate about that, hasn't there?
Yeah. Anyway. I've definitely got a female menopause, so...
We're going to get going, and we're going to start with a quick fire round so that people can get to know you. So the first question is, how long have you been in your current role?
I haven't really got a current role. I have been running businesses as an entrepreneur since 1996. And before that, I was an electronics engineer.
Yeah. You see, this is where the amazing brain comes from. Describe a snapshot of an ordinary moment in work. What would you be doing?
My philosophy is that chaos is a feature, not a bug of life. So what I would be doing normally is creating chaos, or shuffling chaos, or moving chaos around my desk, or looking for pieces of paper, and that makes my day up, which is looking for stuff that I've thought was really good and lost, and trying to find it again.
And then you do this with your clients, don't you? And I remember this as part of the process, that I can remember going, oh my God, after I'd spoken to you, I'd realised there was so much chaos. I'd got so many ideas, and I'd then got to distill it into 10 chapters. And that was, you know, the prospect of that. And I can remember feeling really overwhelmed at that stage, but you were brilliant at guiding me and getting me to condense those ideas until we ended up with, just give you a quick flash again.
A real book. Well, the thing about the chaos is where all the clever stuff happens and where all the ideas bounce around and you come up with your best thinking there in that chaos. But you're never going to get to creation unless you put some constraints on it. And so you be happy in the chaos, stop trying to control it. But at some point, to get something out the door, to get something shipped, you have to put constraints.
Yeah, and that is a really useful tip. You know what you've just said there, being happy in the chaos. Because I must confess, I feel really uncomfortable in the chaos, as you probably see by my anally retentive office behind me. And all I'm trying to do is to try and bring, you know, to get rid of the chaos. But you're right to, you know, kind of enjoy that process. But again, that's the benefit of having a coach, isn't it? That you can then start to distill down and get rid of the chaos and start to bring it to some conclusions.
And I think you need chaos. I think you need chaos to come up with something different, a bit edgy, to not be the same as everybody else. You need that chaos because you need to bounce ideas. And creating something through the constraints process is the antidote to chaos, but it's also the bloody cause of chaos. Because as soon as you create something, you're going to get feedback. People are going to say, what about this? You're going to get feedback. You're going to see something else. You start seeing the world slightly differently when you create something rather than just consume. And once you create something, when it's out there, all these new chaotic things come back in and start the process again. So you're never out of it. So that's why you've got to get comfortable, because if you keep fighting it, you just feel uncomfortable all the time. You have to get comfortable in the chaos.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. This is so hilarious. I badge this bit as the quick fire round. You knew it wouldn't be.
We haven't shown up yet.
We haven't started. Right, next quick fire question. What's been your greatest business achievement?
Well, I've had lots of nice little business achievements, but I think the greatest one was when I started a company, my own business, in 1996, and then we grew that to 12 people, and we had offices, and we were like so cool, and we had the beanbag room, and you know, everything was really cool. It was that type of business. So that's my greatest achievement. I was really, really proud of that. But I think on the other side, you know, things start to go wrong, and so it's also one of my greatest sadnesses I had to make redundancy. So it's like a bittersweet achievement.
Yeah, but that is an amazing thing. It sounds like a very grown-up business if you had 12 people and beanbags.
Not just 12 people.
And that was you know, ahead of your time. You know, forget Google.
No, we were beanbags first.
Yeah.
We were Friday off for lunch to Balti House in Birmingham every Friday, and the naan breads on the table, the duvet. Yeah, so we were well ahead of our time.
Yeah, no. Well, and that is you all over, isn't it? You know, being the creative person that you are. But you just give us a quick flash of that book you flashed at me. Come on, that is a pretty nice achievement.
Which one?
That
the
blue
client
one.
Book. The blue, yeah. That blue one. Yeah,
come on, have a little brag about that. Come on.
A very recent client, just her book's just come out, Anne Latham with Bloomsbury. It's this year's 2021's business book, Bloomsbury's book of the year. And I was really excited because, and I've opened this page about 7,000 times now, on the acknowledgements page, first word is Debs.
Yeah.
So I was very, very proud of that. That's my giddy happy face. I get so giddy and happy to see clients things. They turn those thoughts into things. Like your book makes me so excited to see it. Anne's book, I just get really excited to see the things that my clients make. I'm proud of them.
I know that feeling as a fellow coach. It's so nice, isn't it? Seeing people Indeed.
And to know that you had even the tiniest little part in that process makes our jobs worthwhile, makes my job worthwhile.
Yeah. Yeah. Facilitating magic.
Is that in your book?
Yeah, no.
Oh gosh, that's gonna be in the next book. What's this about? Chaos again, yeah, darling.
I know. Don't know if I'm gonna write another. No, I probably will do one day. So what I've been doing for this interview is I've been dipping in and out of the various chapters of the book, and then the questions are around the content of the book. So the first question is relating to chapter one. So each chapter talks about antidotes to imposter syndrome, workaholism and stress. And whenever we're about to embark on any change, it's important we know our coordinates, because knowing where we're at helps us to identify, well, actually, if this is where I'm currently now, where do I therefore want to travel to? So what's happening now in your business life?
Well, for a while, I've had quite a few different business lives. I was an engineer, an electronics engineer, and then we did website design and marketing, and then I've been a writing coach. I ran a publishing company. Right now, recently, I've been helping clients write their books. And also, I've been ghostwriting books now. I've actually ghostwritten quite a few books, and some you might have even read.
Hey!
But I'm stopping doing that. There you go. Been there, done that. So I'm stopping ghostwriting, and the reason is, so I'll help clients write their books, but I'm not writing for them anymore. And it's because it's actually, it's incredibly challenging. It's incredibly exhausting to put yourself into someone else's head and write like them. So
yeah,
I need to back off a little bit and protect a bit of my own energy and time. So not doing that anymore.
I hadn't realised that would be, but it makes sense. I suppose it's a bit like being an actor, isn't it? You know, where you adopt a character.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And sometimes, like when I'm in the middle of a book with a client, I actually can hear their voice and I start speaking like them to other people. And it's like, that's not me. I didn't say that. That's my client. And you think about things in a different way, because I never want to put my ego in their book, my agenda in their book. So I have to become a blank slate and absorb them to some degree. And it is exhausting. Yeah. And, you know, I can help more clients if I have more energy. So my goal is to help more people rather than one or two very exhaustingly.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. So what are you excited about? What are you working on? Tell us about this Better Than Great.
Okay, so the thing with me, I don't know about you guys, but the thing with me is not very good at working on one thing at a time, even though that's my advice. And I've read all the books. I have read Essentialism. I have read The One Thing. I have read all the books, I know, but I'm not very good at working on one thing at a time. I am very good at working on one idea at a time with lots of things within an idea. So the big idea at the moment is Better Than Great. And that's what I'm working on. So I'm writing the books, because there's a couple of books in it. But the Better Than Great book is the main book. And I'm also creating a group of people who, consultants, experts, specialists, coaches, who want to be better than great. And I'm going to show them how to do it.
Ooh, and what is Better Than Great about? So give us some insights.
Well, my premise is that great is given. All my coaches, all my clients, all of you are already bloody great. And in fact, if you weren't great, you wouldn't be being selected. You wouldn't be doing the work that you're doing. So great is a given, and it's a sort of like, heading to great when you're already at great. Where do you go next? We have to go better than great. So what's better than great? Now, some clients, some consultants, some coaches will get stuck in trying to be better and better and better and greater and greater and greater at that thing. The thing that they do, they're already great. Obviously, keep learning. I absolutely always keep learning. But better than great is done. That's a new better than great. So when you have all these ideas in your head, that are still in your head and don't actually get turned into physical assets like a book or a program or a framework or a podcast, but they're just stuck in your head, idea debt, then yeah. Better that they're great. I mean, you know, they're great ideas. You've had them. They're your brilliant ideas. You've probably tested them out on a few people, but when they're stuck in your head or stuck on your desk or stuck on your computer, that's not better than great. So better than great in that case would be done, would be shipped, would be turned into a product. So what I'm helping clients do is go, they're already great. Now we have to create things that demonstrate how bloody great they are.
Nice. I love it. So what are you feeling challenged by at the minute?
Time. My other half is quite, it's very scientific, and he's writing a book to explain why time doesn't exist. So I'm feeling very, it doesn't exist, time does not exist. It's a made-up concept. So what am I feeling stressed about at the moment? What's feeling challenged by time? And finding enough time to dedicate to the important things that I want to do. And one of the things I've been saying recently, mainly because I'm a sarcastic bitch, is loads of people on Twitter, I don't know, you may have seen it, Twitter and LinkedIn, lots of people are saying, at the intersection of blah and blah, I'm at the intersection of AI and psychology, I'm at the intersection of, you know, I don't know.
I'm not big on Twitter, but I've not. So expand, what's it all about then?
It's all about people are trying, there's been a big sort of push saying, you need to be a polymathical, and I agree that we do need to be polymathical. We need to have lots of things that we can do and lots of areas that we can draw upon. But what people are starting to say is they're playing this in the intersection of blah and blah. And it, when more than one person does it, it just starts to irritate me. Because now it's not special. It's like, oh. So I've started saying I'm at the intersection of yesterday and tomorrow.
Nice.
Do you like?
Yeah.
I'm in the present moment, my love. I'm in the present moment. I'm at the intersection of yesterday.
And how does that influence your perception of time? Is that better? Has it had a positive impact on
it? Really, really has, because it stopped me from panicking about the things I didn't do yesterday or worrying about the things I did 20 years ago. And it stopped me from being so focused on the future that I don't actually enjoy today.
Yeah. Nice. I like it. I like it. See, I always learn something when I'm with you. You've used some big words there that I was about to say. Can you expand? But you have expanded. So that's cool. So obviously this book is about imposter syndrome, which is, it's kind of the flavour of the moment, isn't it? Out on social media. By the time my book comes out, I'm thinking it'll have gone out of fashion.
Good enough. We need to make everybody feel imposter syndrome so they buy
until then, until the 25th of March 2022. So when have you experienced imposter syndrome? How does it work for you?
I get a little bit of imposter syndrome every time I speak to clients, every single time, every call, every intervention, every coaching call, every time we start looking at a book or we look at a project that we're working on. Every single time I speak to a client, I get a bit of imposter syndrome. And that's sort of like, well, who am I to advise them? And, it reminds me that one of my ex-husbands used to always say to me, you only need to be one chapter ahead in the book.
Yes, my stepson says the same thing.
Yeah, is a software engineer or?
No, he works in... I always get the term wrong.
Don't tell me. It's not a software engineer, but my ex is a software engineer, and he always says, you need to be one chapter ahead in the book. You need to be one chapter ahead in the book. And then it helps me realise that, well, I'm at least one chapter in the book. I've written some of the books, and so it makes you feel a tiny little bit, I can do this. But I have that sort of uncomfortable shudder feeling. Pretty much every conversation.
But I, because imposter syndrome strikes when we're new to a role, you know, that's really when it can kick in. New to a role, new to a hobby or anything, I think, we can get that, oh, I'm not good enough, you know. But I wonder, as I was listening to you, because I thought that's interesting every time you speak to a client. But again, I wonder if that's to do with the fact that as a consultant, it's like being new girl lots of times, isn't it? You know, like every time you go into a business, you know, we don't just have one fixed abode where we're dealing with the same people and we're doing the same stuff. Yeah.
Every client is different. And whilst you might be doing the same big thing, so like we're creating something, every client will come with their own differences. And they, you know, they might ask me a question. I'm like, gosh, that's a brilliant question. I wish I'd have thought of the answer to that question before you asked it. But so there's always this, like, and I think if I ever didn't feel a tiny bit of, oh, am I going to be able to deliver, you know, am I going to be able to, I think I probably would be starting to look for something different to do again.
Yeah.
I like the feeling, it keeps me on my toes.
Yes, yeah. And I liked what you said in your answers about, you know, it keeps you humble and, like you say, shows and all that kind of thing. And studies are showing that actually it's great for performance, in that it drives our performance on. But I would say people end up in my coaching chair when they get to a tipping point. So that imposter syndrome has then led to overworking, so workaholism and stress. So they're overdoing all of those traits. And you know, one of the things I will, because I sit and I look at my clients and I think, you are bloody amazing, can't you see what I can see? And you know, it's that, when is, I talk about enoughness, when is enough, and it's always having a healthy balance, isn't it, of those imposter syndrome thoughts, so that you don't over egg the pudding, so to speak.
Yeah, because I think if you're too confident, obviously clients want to know they're in safe hands, they want to know that you know what you're doing, right? Here's how I think of it. But they also want to know that you're an eternal learner too, that you're always finding something new. So you don't have to know all the answers, but there is I come to a call ready to answer as many, or to lead in the right direction, or to guide, or to help. But I always know that there's going to be something I don't know, and that's exciting. It's a bit, for me, feeling a little bit of imposter syndrome is a little bit like feeling in the chaos. It's like being comfortable for me with that chaos of not necessarily knowing everything.
Yeah. And also, I always think it makes life exciting, or work life exciting, not knowing everything. Because I remember when I first trained as a coach, and we used to go to our coaching CPD days and all that kind of thing, and we'd all be like puffing our chests out going, oh, what are you learning? What have you qualified in? How many clients have you got? So total imposter syndrome thoughts going on. And I used to feel quite, you know, like overwhelmed by that thought of, oh my God, they know this and I don't know that and blah, blah, blah. And then the penny dropped. I thought, actually, if we reframe that, that's what makes work life exciting. The fact that there is so much, you know, you and I love books. We've only got to look behind you to see. You know, and books for me are like sweets. Do you know what I mean? Like, anyway.
It's delicious. And I think as well, I don't think imposter syndrome is going to go away. And I don't think I should. I think if I overthink, because I'm a brilliant overthinker, that's one of my best skills. If you need something overthunked, send it to me. I think if I get too caught up in that feeling, then that's when it all goes wrong. But if I just say, okay, I'm feeling a little bit, it's a nice anxious feeling. I like that anxious feeling. It means I'm coming to it with a bit of energy. I like it. I kind of like it. But it is imposter syndrome. I do like, oh gosh, who am I to tell them what to do? You know, I have sort of fantastic, wonderful clients, so smart. And oh my gosh.
I know, it's a funny old thing, isn't it? So we're going to move on to chapter 2, which is entitled Captaining Your Ship. So it's all about taking charge of yourself, your results, and coming off autopilot, because with a worst case scenario, we are 99% on autopilot, so only 1% conscious choice.
And the whole 1%?
No, no, it's shocking. And of course, all of these, you know, that 19, I had to do the math just then, that 99% of autopilot, that autopilot comes from your childhood. So it's all of those those programs that are laid down, which is when we get onto chapter five or six, I don't remember. But the chapter about havening, where we change, we alter those programs so that if we do slip to autopilot, the behavior is different. But captaining your, I nearly said shit. Captaining your ship. I knew it'd get like this between you and I.
We know.
Is about taking charge, because actually we've got scope to increase our captaining to 5%. So if we're self-aware and we raise our awareness of what's going on, we take charge, which again, you learn about throughout the book. We imagine us, you know, being 5% in charge as opposed to 1%, and the difference, you know, makes to our performance.
Five times improvement. I mean, wow. I would be happy with like a 0.5% improvement.
It's really cool stuff. And so if we're talking about the things that create those programs and create our autopilot, and it's connected with limiting beliefs, behaviors, and emotions, which were, again, set in your childhood. So how do you know it's time to change a limiting belief, behavior, or emotion? And I can see your answer here. And I'm like, oh my God, you've written that twice on the answers, and I'm dying to know what it's about. Come on.
Okay, is this thing, I call it Dave brain. Sorry, Dave.
Why Dave brain? So 4 a.m. Dave brain, what is that about?
Okay, well, at 4 o'clock, I don't know what your time is. My time is, if anything is stressing me or anything is worrying me or anything needs fixing, I wake up at 4 o'clock and that's what I'm thinking about. I'm mithering about it. And yeah. I think it's like, do you know the Dave channel?
Yes. Yeah.
Right. And you know, every time you switch it on, there's going to be a repeat of Only Fools and Horses, yeah, or a repeat of Casualty, or a repeat of Holby City, a repeat of whatever the day brain channel is repeating. It's repeat, it's repeat, repeat, repeat. That's its job, is repeat funny things. Anyway,
yeah.
That's what I get at 4 o'clock. I get day brain channel on, repeating the things that have been mithering me. And that's when I know that if I've seen that repeat more than once or twice in the last week, that I need to do something, I need to fix it. There's a thought that's, you know, that's not going away. So it's, if I get 4 a.m. day brain, then I've got to do something to change my life.
Yeah. No, I love it. You see. Yeah, I see. This is your creativity coming to the fore. I refer to it as Groundhog Day. So we're just reliving the same old things. Yeah. I read some ridiculous statistic. I'm probably going to misquote now, but I think it was something like 80% of our thoughts are the same. And most of them are negative. So that's high octane autopilot, isn't it? If we're just having the same old thoughts.
For me, when I get day brain at 4 o'clock in the morning, it's like it's like a trigger with the adverts in between. I get that thought goes round, get an advert where it's like, oh, maybe I can go back to sleep now. And then the next program comes on. So now I start with it. So once the first program is worrying about work, advert. Now I'm starting to worry about my mom, advert. Now I'm starting to, and it's this sort of like cycle of day brain repeats the same channel, the same programs again and again. And that's when I know I need to do something, because usually if I'm getting 4 a.m. day brain, there's something not quite right for me, and there's something I need to fix.
And I'm just going to segue into this part here. Look, you're at one of your other many books. She's written many books, folks. Look her up, Debbie Jenkins on Amazon. So I've just held up, if you're listening, the little book of big decisions, and you said it's an indication you need to do something. Well, this book is brilliant for that. Because it is forcing doing something, isn't it? You've got to take a decision, decide, move on.
Well, you know, you said about most of our thoughts are negative and then the same thoughts. I was finding that with my decisions. So I'd make a decision, probably a negative one, like I'm never doing that again. So not in the stated in the positive, not stated in a, you know, an expansive, wonderful, that I'm never doing that again. And I'd make that decision and then next week I'd be doing it again. I am never eating 2 bars of chocolate again. Never, ever, ever doing that again. And then the day after I'd eat 2 bars of chocolate. No, it was that type of decision. Obviously, I was talking more about businesses, but that's probably an easy one to explain. I was finding that I'd make a decision. I'd even write it down, like it was such a good decision. I'd write it down, and then a few weeks later, I'd have completely forgotten it and make the same decision again. So I started collecting it in my tiny little red book, I don't know where it is now, in a tiny, just a little notebook. And that's where the idea for that came from. I felt like, if I, you know, I don't think I'm that special. Obviously, I am very special.
Exactly.
I don't think I'm that special. And I think if I'm, this is how I suggest all my clients when they're writing and creating something, they can create, if they could create something for themselves, what would they create? Because then that probably would be useful to other people.
Yeah.
And that's why I came up with that idea for that book.
No, it was brilliant. It really give me, I sound a rat northern, give me a kick up arse. to make some decisions. Yeah, and I can see here, to run a Strat Club webinar. Well, that's all ticked and diddly done, so it definitely works.
And it's a bit different to normal journaling, I think. It's like, I think writing down your thoughts or your, and certainly decisions is a good idea. But sometimes we just write them down in a very passive way, whereas this book is to like, I made the decision, what's my next step? Do it, go for it, make it done.
Exactly. No, I love it. So we're going to move on now to chapter 3, which is understanding what causes you to sink. So this is all about, so you remember I was saying there's a tipping point. So throughout the book, there is a sailing analogy. But what I tend to find is that people, you know, particularly during this pandemic, oh my goodness, the leaders I've been coaching that have been literally drowning in the, you know, everything that's been going on, repivoting the business, but also poor souls having to be strong for the teams that they manage and not offloading or processing their own emotions, which was then causing them to sink. And of course, if the leader goes under, you know, the impact's big on the rest of the team. So what causes you to sink, or you know, what are the kind of positive and negative childhood experiences that have influenced your personality?
You know, this thing about chaos. Right? Okay, well, when I finally understood that I could not control the world, still not sure, I might still be able to, but like as I got closer and closer to understanding that I can't control everything and everybody and all the environment, that's when I understood that chaos was a feature in our book. And I was like, when I thought about that and we talked about it, I had coaching with you and you helped me see that this control freakery, I am a recovering control freak, this control freakery comes from my childhood. I was the oldest daughter of four, and if something had to get done, I'd be the one who did it. I step forward, everyone steps back. Anything, anytime anything needed to be done, I would get out there, do it, you know, whatever needed to be done. You know, the crazy things like, you know, my dad's funeral, someone needs to do the eulogy. Well, yeah, I stuck my hand up. Yeah. Crazy people do that. I think the thing that probably holds me back, the thing that, when things aren't going right, it's probably because I'm holding on too tight and trying to control all the world. And I think it comes from being the oldest daughter.
And what's the impact, you know, of, so the controlling, the, you know, doing everything for everyone. What was the impact on you? How did it make you at risk of sinking?
I was always feeling disappointed in myself and in the world, and you know, there was always a gap between my expectations of what I could control and what I could make happen and reality.
Yeah.
Reality is the only thing that I've got even slight amount of tiny control over is me. And like you've just said, I've only got 1% of that is conscious control. So, you know, it's like, well, yeah, Deb, so just be calm about that. But the impact, it would be disappointment, I think, in myself and in the world. That would be one impact. And being responsible is also, it's bloody tiring. If you're always the responsible one, you're always the one who's got to, you know, you're the one who gets into the office first and out last, and you're the one who always over-delivers to your clients and over-delivers to your family. It's exhausting.
Yeah,
absolutely shattering. And these days, especially like COVID, where everyone feels a little, not everyone, maybe lots of people feel a bit more exhausted than usual. I think, like, you know, Deb, chillax, control freakery out the window.
Yeah. And so what have you done to get over your, you say you're recovering control freakery. So what's helped?
Coaching with you helped, was one of the big things that made a difference for me. Getting comfortable, see, I know I've said it like 1,000 times, but getting comfortable in chaos. It's like, you know, I look around my desk, I've got animals everywhere. You cannot have control if you have 100% control with animals. Yeah, but when I was 40, I started learning to ride horses. You cannot control a horse, not 100%. You have to learn that is not possible. You have to give a little bit of the, you know, you have to be a partner in it. It's not, I am 4'10" and I cannot control a 600-kilo horse by the force of my strength. I have to be in relationship with that, in partner. So I think you learn, I think, eventually.
yeah. And it's interesting because often, and you know, the control pattern is a really popular pattern I work with clients, and often it's installed. So I talk about, you know, so control can be a value, but it can also be a skill, something that a behavior that we adopt. And of course, behavior comes from values, and it can be a towards or an away from. And so control can often be a thing that makes us feel safe. So if I'm in control, then I feel safe. But what's interesting is actually, and I've been working with a client just recently who has very much controlled the sessions, very much, you know, being in charge of the sessions, control being really important to them. But actually, it was leading to anxiety. So again, it's that overdoing something. So it's done for safety, but actually when we overdo it, and again, it depends where it comes from and why it was installed, the need for control. But again, often it's in childhood and it's a mechanism for feeling safe. But yes. Right. I am going to ask you one more question before we go to our quick fire round. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to skip to chapter 8, which is about developing your inner captain. And this is really important. In terms of, so what I've noticed with my clients is those that do best, so not only do we do deep change work together, so we do the havening stuff, but also they learn to wrestle with and take charge of their inner captain thoughts, you know. And this is important when it comes to imposter syndrome, so things like I'm afraid I'm going to get found out, I'm not good enough, I'm going to get this wrong, I've got to get it right. So all of that negative inner dialogue then can, you know, cause problems behaviorally, either as a leader, as an exec, whoever it is. So once you've got a significant piece of change work out of the way, it's on this developing your inner captain is a bit like the maintenance program. So just as you were describing earlier, a thought comes up and then you have a word with yourself and you counter it. So what in a phrase do you use which helps to enhance your performance?
It's a beautiful phrase, and it's come from a really beautiful story. I was 7 years old. I don't know, do you remember when you used to go to school at seven, you just had an assembly at the beginning of the day and you'd sit on the floor in your tights with your legs crossed on the herringbone floor. Anyway, so imagine sitting on the floor. Our headmaster, it was the best storyteller in the whole world. It's him who put the, you know, this idea that I could write in my head. And his name is Mr. Hyden. Anyway, he would tell us this story and he'd tell it once a year because for the new kids.
Yeah.
And the story was, about him going to a table making factory in Birmingham. I don't even think they existed, but you know, as a 7 year old, you're like, oh, that's so exciting. And he spotted a guy sitting on the floor polishing the underside of the table.
Yeah.
And my headmaster said to him, "Why are you polishing the underside of the table? No one will ever see it. No one's going to put their dinner on it. There's no, you know, no one's going to put their papers on it. No one's going to ever see it." And the table polisher guy said, "Only my best is good enough for me."
Nice. Yeah.
That became a burden, yes. But also, as I've got older, less of a burden and more of an aspiration. Because there was a time in my life where I was thinking, but why if my best isn't good enough? I went through that. Yeah. Moment and now I feel like I'm back to the other side of it, because I've always said only my best is good enough for me, only my best is good enough for me. If I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it to my best. I'm not going to do it half-assed. I'm not going to just do it a bit. I'm not going to do a bad job for anybody. Only my best is good enough for me. But then I went through this phase of, well, what if my best isn't good enough?
Yes.
Like comparing myself with other people, comparing myself with the rest of the world. And now I've got back out of that feeling of that it's not been a good phrase for me, and back to the nice side of it, which is only my best is good enough for me, and I only have to compare me with me yesterday. I don't have to compare me with anybody else. I just have to compare me with me, and if I'm doing my best, then I feel good.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's that enoughness again, isn't it? When is enough enough? And yeah. Again, the comparison pattern is just so popular, comparing yourself to other people. You know, it's like stay in your own lane. We're only in competition with ourselves, really, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah. And we only got control of ourselves, and 1% control of ourselves.
Yeah.
That's stuck with me now. My arms are just going to fly off and do their own thing. I have no control. It's not my fault.
Not me.
Autopilot. I didn't do it. Autopilot did that. Autopilot.
So we move on to the quick fire round.
Oh,
so,
gosh.
What's something people get wrong about you?
People, they tend not to get this wrong on Zoom, because I think we have like there's, but if they meet me in person, I'm very small and look childish, childlike.
Young.
People think young. No, not I don't know. People think I'm all soft and gentle, and they're wrong. They are so wrong. I am scary, dangerous, mean. I'm a mean girl.
Well, tell them what you used to be called.
I used to be called Dangerous Debbie Jenkins.
Yeah. Why did you get that nickname?
Because for a while, when I was running the marketing company, the one that got bigger, got to 12 people, we were basically going into companies and saying, everything you know about marketing is wrong. You've been lied to. It's wrong. We were kind of against traditional marketing. So I like being against things. So I'm a generally have been take a stance. And so that's, don't think I'm softy pants.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Did you hear that Tommy rumble then? Did it come out there?
That was fear.
No, it's just the lack of eating because I've been naughty at the weekend. So what's your morning routine or ritual? Do you have anything?
Hey, no. I drew a picture about this. I'll send you my picture. My morning routine, usually, there is a semi-morning routine, but it's usually got something to do with stepping over dogs and cats and attempting to make coffee as quickly as possible. I do have a routine in that I try not to do distracting work first thing. To hear the try.
Yeah.
And try to do something, one win the day type thing first, because then at least I've started the day off well. But that usually, you know, usually involves falling over a dog or treading on a cat or something.
Nice. What have you binge? I nearly said bonged. What have you binged watched? What have you binged?
Oh, over August, because I always take August off. I take the whole of August off. We binge watched The Blacklist.
What's that?
I don't know. It's an American. It's actually kind of good. It's on Amazon Prime, and it's about Reddington, and it's worth watch. But we tend to binge watch anything that's got been Spanish dubbed, because my other half's Italian, and we live in Spain. And our common language is Spanish, so everything has to. Yeah. So you have to have something that's dubbed.
Nice. What's your favourite quote or saying?
I made this one up ages and years ago now, which is, if you're not having fun, what are you having?
Nice. I like it.
Yeah, I made it up. I used to be on the Dangerous Debbie. When I was Dangerous Debbie, I had knickers with, if you're not having fun, what are you having, printed on them.
You were dangerous, weren't you?
Yeah, I used to throw those knickers at the audience as well.
Laundered, I hope. Then the final, we like to close on. So yes. What's your biggest insider secret?
Okay, this is for anybody who is an expert in what they're doing, and, you know, the smart people, the experts, the consultants, the coaches. My insider secret for you type of people is that you probably have and know more than you realize you do. You're probably sitting on hidden value, on assets that the rest of the world need to see, and you just don't realize quite how brilliant they are. And that's my insider secret. You don't need to keep creating new things. Yeah. You've probably got everything you need already. You just didn't know it.
That is so exciting. And especially, you know, if you suffer with imposter syndrome, you know, like, oh, I can't do it, you know, I couldn't write a book or whatever else. That's really reassuring.
I can find your value. I can help you work out what you're sitting on, what you're hiding, that your clients, your potential clients would absolutely love from you.
Lovely. So how do people, what would you like to promote, or how do people connect with you? Tell us.
Okay. The best place is on theassetpath.com, which is for consultants and coaches to help them turn their clever thoughts into valuable things. And that's where you'll find out about the Better Than Great book and the Better Than Great program. And you can find my books on there if I put them on there. Or you can come to debbiejenkins.com, where that's where you'll find out about being helped to write your own book.
Yeah, cool. And what's your social media handle? How do they? Debs Jenkins.
Everywhere I am Debs Jenkins. Facebook, Debs Jenkins. LinkedIn, Debs Jenkins. Twitter, Debs Jenkins.
Yeah, lovely. That's great. I knew it'd be funny, and I knew. Do you remember we were going to do that naughty podcast together?
We were.
It's not been. I can't remember the name of it, but
Lucky Bitches.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Just had to get it out there.
I had to say it out loud.
Oh, but I will be eternally grateful for your support in helping me put my book together. You know, you're a wonderful woman. I'd love to meet you in person one day.
That would be so weird.
I know it would.
And wonderful.
It would be lovely. But thank you so much. I knew you'd be brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Leader Insider Secrets. You can help this podcast grow by leaving an honest review. Also, if you want to get future episodes, remember to hit subscribe. Finally, if you're interested in working with me, you can book a free 30-minute discovery session, or you can connect and access other resources in the link below. I'm Estelle Reed at B.Company, executive coach, trainer, and author. This has been Leader Insider Secrets.